The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 70.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to bring someone to the Rebel Capitalist Show that I really, really enjoy watching on Real Vision Television, one of my favorite sources for macro information. His name is Hugh Hendry. Hugh, welcome to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
George, thank you. Thank you so much. It is great to be at Rebel Base Camp.
All right, buddy. So for my viewers who might not know your backstory, can you fill them in on that? Because it's really fascinating.
Yeah. So I set up a global macro hedge fund called Eclectica Asset Management in October 2002. So a long time ago. And I want to say that I achieved tenure in the sense that I ran it for 15 years. Hedge funds are like restaurants. They're opening up all the time and they're closing.
Right.
And we always write about the big returns that these damn hedge fund guys make. It's the return to the survivor, and no one talks about the guy who fails. And there's so many failures.
Right.
So when I look back, and now I'm at one of those points in life where you kind of look back, you know, for kind of guidance, how did I get here? But I take something very positive from the tenure. And then I was just different. I was not your regular hedge fund guy. Right. And I took ownership. I always kind of, my marketing department would say, please don't tell the story. And I'm going to tell the story. But I was like a paranoid schizophrenic in terms of idea generation. I heard voices in my head, and it led me to take actions. And those actions were to invest other people's money on the basis of these voices. And then having done that, I was paranoid and terrified. And so talk about safe custody. I watched those positions like a hawk, if you will.
Yeah.
And the voices in my head, really, I looked at charts. And charts became like sheet music. Yeah, and I could, with the technology available, I could look at thousands of charts and go through all the indices in the world and all the asset classes. And there was a particular pattern that I was looking for. And when I found it, I became very curious. And then I was very fortunate that I had this intelligence team, these straight guys and girls. And I could say, hey, look, I'm crazy, but I think this thing is going to do a moonshot. This thing is going up. I don't know why. So I want you to go out into the world. I want you to investigate, speak to the experts, you know,
right,
and make up your own opinion and come back and challenge me. And that's what we did. And so 15 years, I want to say we compounded. I want to say that our average returns were between 7 or 8%.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to tell you that essentially that fund correlated to nothing. It was unique. Yeah. So in the month of October 2008, I made a TV program. I made a TV program for British terrestrial television called "Don't Bank on the Bailout." If you go to YouTube, you'll be able to see excerpts of that. And I made 50% that month. So go figure.
For the month
of October 2008.
Wow.
We made 50. For the year, we made about 32%.
Yeah. Wow, awesome.
So when I say we made 7 or 8% on average, it was a function of those high years. Another high year, we made 50% for the calendar year 2003, 17 years ago, a long time ago. I was kind of one of the first of the new generation to, again, to say, hey, look, guys, I feel a vibration under my seat, like something's going on in the gold market. This could be a geyser. This thing's going to take off. Again, I don't know why. And of course, I find out. We'll perhaps discuss it, because I think that was the first act. I think the second act was the deflationary event, which was 2002. And I think it just so happens to be the virus, but this is the third act in terms of the untold story of where gold has to go, and I'm sure we're going to explore that. But you know,
if I could just pause one moment just to kind of unpack that a little bit. When you say the deflationary event of 2002, when you use the word deflation, what are you referring to specifically? Are you referring to asset prices, a debt deflation, the value of the dollar going down, the DXY, or consumer prices? Because, and the reason I want to make sure we're clear there is because so many of my viewers, they see, and I think everyone in the CNBC, you name it, they see inflation or deflation as something that's completely binary. It's just either all prices are going up or all prices are going down. And as you know, that often isn't true. There's nuance to it. So can you explain to the viewer specifically what happened with the deflation during that time?
It's just at the end, you made a very, very great which very few people truly understand. And it's one of these, let me just say it. There is always a bull market somewhere. Even in the most grotesque of events, there is always a bull market somewhere. I mean, I bound out of bed in the morning. I have so much energy in the morning because I know just somewhere under some rock, there's a bull market. Now, to your point, and again, if I perhaps could just correct you, I said, the deflation of 2008, not 2002.
Oh, I'm sorry.
For sure, of course, there had been an enormous deflationary event, which had been the demise of the technology bubble from the year 2000. And I happened to launch my fund kind of at the bottom of that bear market for risk assets. But to your point, when I say a deflationary event, I am talking about an event whereby professional investors are feeling fearful. Forgive me with this Scottish accent. I hope, you know, on Real Vision, they put subtitles against me.
No, it's totally clear.
I can speak French. Je peux parler français si tu veux, to English. So I have deflation is when these so-called professional investors, when they're kind of going, holy, you know what, I'm really fearful, which is to say it's a moment when risk asset prices, typically stock market prices, are falling.
Right.
Now, why that becomes interesting, and my world is a world of drama, it's a world of color, it's a world of theater, and why it's an engaging avenue for me, an intervention point, is because it turns gray bureaucrats into swashbuckling buccaneers who want to save the world like James Bond. Now, so typically, and with respect, I don't mean that. It's so easy to demean our public officials. Sometimes it's merited, sometimes it's not. And I know in the gold and the Bitcoin community, there's a lot of hating, if you will. And I always prefer to be a lover and to be, you know, if we can always seek forgiveness. Now, the guys who run the Federal Reserve, I want to say they mean good, yeah? But these are people who are bureaucrats. They're not paid money like hedge fund guys, all right? They're not paid money to take risks. And the biggest risk that they have is how history will judge their actions. And I, you know, the central bank policies that we have seen since the stock market and the housing market crash of 2008, again, these would be deflationary events. I want to say that their actions were brave. And I want to paraphrase, brave means they were contentious, that they were actions which were unconventional. And again, beyond their pay packet, and where they were potentially taking on the wrath of history, that history could judge their actions to be wrong. And that's something that would be a legacy for their family in the future. Okay. So I think so far, kind of they took the right path. I know there's this tremendous and grotesque income disparity, but increasingly we're faced with alternatives which are not fantastic. And I would still want to say that the path that they took averted a Great Depression Part Two at the turn of this century. After the housing crash of this unprecedented housing crash in 2007, 2008, we came so close to the American economy shrinking by like 20% and having unemployment of 20%. And I think their actions prevented that happening. Now, they made errors, etc. But anyway, so for me, deflation is an event which makes policymakers brave and they take radical policy actions, okay? And so in 2000, I had closed out my positions in gold in about the end of 2005, because I said that we needed something really bad, profoundly concerning, that would shake our economic principles and foundations to the core. And I imagined that it would be a synchronized house price decline across all the states in America. Something that they told, the experts said, was impossible.
Yeah. Right.
And I thought, life's all about the impossible becoming reality.
Right.
And I said that gold at that point would suffer, but you had to change the interest rate regime of the Fed, because at the time, the Federal Reserve, I think interest rates peaked 5.25%, the official overnight Fed funds rate. And I was saying, for the second or the third chapter to open up, we need this deflationary drama in order for the Fed to follow the path of the Bank of Japan and cut interest rates like radical, like desperate men trying to break out of prison. And if we came down to zero interest rates, this was 2005. I'm saying, if you think the future is inflationary, you have to buy treasuries, because this terrible event's going to happen. The Fed's going to slash rates to zero. And initially, people will find comfort in rising bond prices.
Mm-hmm.
But then the next trade will be into gold. So, anyway, forgive me, it can be, sometimes I can overcomplicate these matters, but it's a wonderful drama. One day we'll make a great book or a great movie.
I'm very hard on the Fed in my videos. But I will admit that if you're just looking at what's the best thing to do to tide the economy over for the short term, it's absolutely money printing or doing what they're doing. I know a lot of people like Jeff Snyder would argue that what they're doing is more psychological, but regardless of what it is, for a short term, it is definitely beneficial. I just get really concerned with the long-term consequences of the Fed continually expanding their balance sheet. As an example, in 2007, beginning of 2008, it was around $800 billion. And then just recently, it was up to $4.5 trillion. It went back down a little bit. But then we had the repo spike in September 17th. It started going back up. Now it's who knows, $7, $8 trillion. And it's probably on its way to $10 trillion plus. And I just
I'd say it's closer to $50 trillion. Truly measured, it's closer to $50 trillion. The U.S. economy is $17 trillion, $18 trillion. The Fed's balance sheet is like 3x the U.S. economy. It's insane in terms of numbers.
Yeah, so my point is I know that we're all humans, and even if the Fed's intentions are good, they're dealing with a complex system, just like nature. And there's no way that they can just dial that thermometer in precisely. And there's bound to be unintended consequences. So my concern is that the unintended consequences are greater than the benefit of the short-term gain. What do you think about that?
I would come back to you with a question. What is the unintended consequence that really grates, that really makes you upset?
The currency, because I think at the end of the day, that's most likely the release valve. And although it doesn't happen immediately, I think once you get velocity in the economy, and once the Fed or the government is able to get the money growth in the actual back pockets of the individuals, then velocity picks up. One thing that I really liked about what you said to Raul the other day in your conversation is you pointed out in 2012, you thought, or a lot of people thought, that there was going to be hyperinflation because the Fed took their balance sheet to such extremes. But you pointed out that the velocity just tanked. I mean, it just fell off a cliff. So you didn't see that type of inflation because velocity was so low. But then I think it through and I see, well, why was velocity so low? And I'm thinking, and this is just a hypothesis, it might have been because a lot of the money, the M2 growth, went into the financial system. So since the M2 growth goes into financial assets, it doesn't have as much velocity as it would if that entire 100% of that M2 growth would have gone into people's, you know, the poor and middle class, their checking account. Then velocity increases, you get the inflation. And I just, I don't know, maybe it's because I never studied economics, but I always come from a standpoint of there's no free lunch and we just can't print consumption. And if we do try to print consumption, at the end of the day, there's going to be a negative consequence. Maybe it's too much of a simpleton view, but that's kind of how I see it.
Okay, so if you would allow me to kind of paraphrase what I think you just told me, you believe that the thing that you push back against the Fed, the thing that's made you cross with the Fed, is that they have made us vulnerable to this unintended consequence, which would be a spike in the velocity of the circulation of currency within the American economy.
Yeah, and the malinvestment too, the misallocation of resources and malinvestment.
Okay. And you say that can have long-term consequences. Would you accept that they have been pursuing this radicalization for just over 10 years, from 2009? Yeah. And we really haven't seen those unintended consequences as yet, because the great surprise, I was wrong with my anger in 2012. My anger, which began at the end of 2008. You know, I had seen the coming crash and I had profited for my clients and for myself. Like Andrew Mellon, the former Treasury Secretary from the late 1920s, I wanted them to purge the damn system of its rottenness. All these rotten, corrupt finance hedge fund people. Clear the stables, yeah, and we didn't. We chose another course, which was this kind of funny money thing. That cost me 3 years of performance. I made no money. Yeah, if you remember 2009, gold kind of went from, I want to say, like went from $500 to like almost two, went up four times, and I missed that because I was angry and I was calling names to the Fed. I am not the moral guardian. I was the guardian of some rich people's money. I was not the guardian of their moral principles. And it was not my role to call out and shame other people. You know, it was ridiculous. So anyway, but the remarkable thing, George, is here we are, and we haven't seen an explosion in the velocity in terms of the circulation of dollar bills in the US economy. We haven't seen a debasement vis-a-vis other currencies in the world of the US dollar. If anything, the US dollar has traded higher vis-a-vis the euro and the yen, etc., and the Aussie dollar, etc. And we haven't seen, it's not obvious we've seen an enormous malinvestment. I mean, one could certainly question the amount of corporate resources being used to leverage balance sheets to buy back stock. That kind of feels kind of, but even then it's, you know, there's an argument that when the 10-year treasury rate is yielding zero and you have a solid, robust cash flow generating business, what the PE you put on that is like really, really high. You know, so you could say that they're kind of just buying these cheap perpetual equity. So kind of over 10 years, none of that's happening. And yet we're still naming and shaming the Fed. Now, that's how you've got, you know, one of the things you've got to be careful when you are trying to invest is the kind of this emotional thing. Just like call a spade a spade. And so far, this system the one thing that this radical monetary policy has done is, up until this dreadful virus, U.S. economy was rocking. Yeah, the dollar was strong. Anyone that wanted a job had a job. So, but there's trouble coming. This is the third act. I'd still push back
just a little bit. I think you made a great point with the buybacks, and now we're seeing a lot of these companies go out of business because they don't have the resources to last them just for a month or two. And I think if you just look at these corporations, just like you would your own personal balance sheet, and say, listen, it's prudent to have a rainy day fund. And I think the main reason these guys don't have a rainy day fund is because of how the Fed incentivized them to go into the market and buy back their shares, because they got to go further out the risk curve to get yield. I'd look at pension funds as well, especially, you know, these pension funds are so underfunded because the Fed drops rates down to zero for, call it, 8 years. And they're accustomed to getting 5 or 6% on a treasury, which is, you know, call it a risk-free return. And they have to get a 7% return to meet their liabilities. Well, you can't go 8 years with the treasuries at 0%. So then it affects all these state pension funds. You look at what it does to savers. It goes back to Hazlitt's book, you know, where you've got the economics in one lesson, where you've got to look at the unseen. And I think if we somehow, although we can, if we quantify the negative effects of what happened due to quantitative easing and keeping interest rates artificially low for so long, if we could quantify that with how many retirees now have to work at Walmart, as an example. I mean, you're in St. Bart's, but if you go to the United States, as an example, in Phoenix or Tucson or Las Vegas, you go to your local Walmart, and I mean, 50% of the people in there are over 80 years old. And I think that could potentially be a direct result of the Fed, because these people build their lives on and their savings and their spending and their consumption around them getting, because their financial planner tells them that they're going to be able to get a 7% return, call it, for the rest of their lives. And if they can get a 7% return for the next 20 years, well, they can increase their levels of consumption. They can do this. So they set up a budget for themselves. Well, after 10 years, if their financial planner comes back to them and says, oh, yeah, by the way, all that consumption that you thought you're going to have in retirement, you don't have anymore because the Fed dropped rates down to 0%. And that's just another thing that I would throw out there. I just think there's a lot of cross currents, and I'm concerned that the Fed, by taking those actions, makes the system more fragile the more action they take. And that, but although in the short term, it definitely smooths things over. So that's this is your interview, so I don't want to talk too long, but that's kind of the tip of the iceberg
These are complex matters, you know, but like short term, it's the short term, the last 10 years, you know, we've pretty much had full employment for the last 10 years. Believe me, in 2008, that did not look a remote possibility. And I want to say that the Fed achieved that. Should the Fed be setting interest rates for the tiny, tiny probability that we have a global pandemic? I certainly hope not. Okay, you know, should corporations be designing their balance sheet for the possibility of a pandemic? I don't think so. Those folk who work in Walmart, it's complicated, you're right. You know, when they came to retirement, they found that an annuity buys you nothing in terms of an annual income. But at the same time, like if we roll the clock back to the Berlin Wall falling and to the emergence, you know, capitalism and the spread of prosperity, we freed billions of people from the serfdom of communism. You know, we've got, you know, almost 2 billion Chinese people who are saying thank you so much. But the cost of our generosity, sadly, is that if you were sitting there and you were kind of through no fault of your own, but you were kind of what we call the unskilled labor force, you kind of find out that you had a couple of billion people overseas that were willing to do what you did for like pennies. Right. And so, like, was it the Fed, or was it the fact that we liberated the world and we asked them to join us in our wonderful economic system? Who knows? Time will tell. But let's go on.
Yeah, no, Hugh, it's a fascinating conversation. I love going back and forth. I also kind of see it, I look at the depression of the early 20s compared to the 1930s, And that's kind of how I see it in my mind as well. Maybe you rip the Band-Aid off, you take more pain at the beginning, but that, you know, you get through it in 2 years.
It doesn't work. It really doesn't work. That's
No, but tell me why that doesn't work, because that really fascinates me.
That's the ideology that I had. You know, that's what they did. What I want to say. I want to say to you
and
that...
I want to be clear, Hugh, I just for the viewers, that there's two different, we got to compartmentalize the conversation, because there's one thing that's right and wrong to do for an investor, a trader, a money manager, someone that's their job to get a return at all times, regardless of what the Fed is doing. And then it's another completely different conversation to have what is the morally correct thing to do, or what's best for the economy over the next 20 years. To your point, you know, the money manager, the guy that's trying to, or the gal trying to make money right now, they can't play that game. They've got to just place their bets based on reality, not what they think should or shouldn't happen.
You name checked the depression that began in the early years of the 1930s.
And 20s.
Where was the depression in the 20s? The depression was the 1930s.
No, 1920. Yeah, let me clarify. Not necessarily depression, but deflation. You had unemployment down lower in 1920 than you had it at the beginning of the depression. All the major statistics and metrics were worse in 1920 than they were in at the beginning of the what we consider the Great Depression.
What I want to say to you is, and what I was attempting to say is that these periods of economic hardship are created by the ideology of the men and the women who set the course for the economy via setting interest rates, who work at the Treasury, who work at the Federal Reserve in the context of America. It doesn't have to be the events that you describe in the early 1920s was an ideology. It was the ideology of hard money, of the dollar being a great store of value. And if the cost meant that your father and his son lost their job, and like the neighbor lost their job, so be it. We were going to take every measure to have the sound, strong money was the most important thing. And this was a factor because we had the First World War. And although the US had kind of been on the sidelines, it had been using its factories to support and supply the effort against
the Spanish flu.
Yeah, absolutely. And so there was a large fiscal moment, which is to say the government spent a great deal. And so there was a fear that we had expanded these paper liabilities, which could open up a temptation to print your way out of it.
Okay.
And all currencies were tied to the dollar. All currencies were tied to the gold standard. And so you had to kind of put on this economic hair shirt and do things to kind of to beat down the economy and to drive out all kind of speculative undertakings. And kind of ordinary people were at the sharp end of all of that. And that followed us into, it was the kind of hard money ideology. There was a lot of people who disagreed with Benjamin Strong and how who'd been the Fed governor and how he had been kind of loosening money to help the Brits. And people said, this is kind of out of hand. And the stock market, of course, was kind of out of hand. It'd gone up a great deal. And so they thought they were engineering a recession. They were increasing interest rates to stop the stock market appreciating, which I would disagree with. It so happened that because they were raising rates when there was like a bubble, bubbles are tremendously febrile environments and they're hard to predict what happens next.
Right. Yeah.
And of course, what happened next was the thing crashed. It came down hard and it took out every commercial bank in the country. And so you had to pull back and change policy, but instead with an ideology, Treasury Secretary Mellon's like, this is great. Purge the system. Purge the system of its rottenness. Let these banks fail. We're not bailing out anyone. Well, anyone. I mean, memories now, of course, that generation is sadly kind of no longer with us. The generation that lost their jobs in the 1930s. But my God, I would hesitate. If I was a policymaker, I would hesitate to inflict that on today's generation. And that's what Bernanke said in, was it October 2003 when he had that helicopter speech?
Yeah. Ben Bernanke, 2002, yeah. I know what you're talking about.
And he said, look, forgive me on behalf of the Federal Reserve. We were wrong. We pursued the ideology of hard money and sticking to the gold standard. And we allowed the great American worker to wither. And that was wrong. And I tell you today, my promise today is we're going to take every measure to make sure that doesn't happen in the future. So that's the story of the last 10 years. I think that's been a success story. But I want to say I'm very fearful for now for the next 10 years. I think when we turn this page, I think we're going to find that you and me, I think you're going to find that we're kind of on the same page and we agree with kind of where we are today.
Yeah. Hugh, how do you see what Volcker did?
These are the tales of heroes, Volcker, yeah. And I kind of want to say, in his own way, Bernanke. They bookend a 50-year cycle in economic prosperity. It's a cycle, it's a bit like, so we are on Earth and we go around the solar system, we orbit the sun. And it takes us as a year. And forgive me, I should be better on this. I think if you're on Saturn or Neptune, I want to say you're further away. I mean, you have people like watching this going, he doesn't know what he's talking about. stick with me, guys. If you know the answer, replace Saturn, Neptune with the answer. But let's call it Neptune. If you're on Neptune, I want to say it takes something like 18 Earth years to go around to complete one orbit. Okay. And so variant perceptions, your perception of reality can be very, very different. Yeah. You might have led a life and never seen snow because you may be a child who grew up and like we had a mild winter and you never saw snow. And so you might never believe that it happens. You know, we have black swan. We talk about black swan events because before we had commercial aircraft and everything else. Australia was, even today, Australia is so far away. But of course, in Australia, they had swans which were black. That was a very rare occurrence. So I want to say to you that 50 years kind of is like a human. Oh, sure, today we live longer. We kind of live between 70 and 80 years is the average for human life. But 50 years is long enough whereby those who kind of knew and those who kind of gained the lessons from the last cycle, they begin to die out, leaving all these kind of like these virgins. Like, kind of like, hey, this is great.
And of course, now there's very few people who live through inflation, as an example, in the United States. Yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely. So the cycle, let's do two cycles. I kind of want to say there was a cycle which began with Henry Ford, and I kind of coincides with the kind of the First World War, and he had this revolution. He said, hey, I'm going to double the pay for my workers. And people's like, you're crazy. You're going to go bust. What are you doing? And he was a genius because he was giving a pay increase to the ultimate consumers of his product. And they felt happy. Their productivity was great. So so the productivity went up. He sold more and he ended up making more. And so became the legend, which was, you know, Henry Ford. And, you know, then we, like I said, we had this ideology of hard money intervened. We had a depression. We were lifted by a war. And then we got into the 1950s of prosperity reemerged and the American deal and people moved to the suburbs and people are getting jobs and productivity surges and profitability is really high. And that's a cycle where the corporation is doing well, but what you find is that labor, the pool of talent, the people who work every day, their share of the economy, of the pie. They're getting to eat every year, they're getting to eat just a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more. Then you fast forward into the 1970s, and by this point, Labour is saying, this is no longer a function of me working hard. This is actually, I deserve this. I merit having a bigger and bigger slice of the profit just because, well, just because. And if you don't agree, well, we are going to organize ourselves into unions, and we're going to stop production. We're going to bring you down, like, if you don't agree. So we reached a point where Labour had taken the capitalist system hostage and was imposing a rent, which was, it was taking too much of the economy's upside out of the system. And of course, we had lost all the dynamic urge. Why would you participate? This would be like Ayn Rand and Atlas Shrugged. This is the point where all the great entrepreneurs give up and we all go to Galt's Glutch. You say, you know what? You keep the business. It's yours, okay? And we had marginal tax rates, which were 97, 98%. Again, if you're a great business person, great mind, you know what? Keep it. Here are the keys to my business. I'm no longer interested. And that was, that cycle peaked round about the bankruptcy of the United Kingdom. Remember when the United Kingdom had to go to the IMF? Cap in hand, please, sir, I'm sorry, we've run out of money. Can you imagine? That cycle ended. And then we got back to your question, which was 10 minutes ago. You asked me about Volcker. We got heroes. Heroes entered the stage. They're heroes because they entered the stage as the cycle was about to change again. So Reagan and Thatcher and Volcker, yeah? And Friedman, Milton Friedman.
Yeah.
And like, it wasn't quantitative easing. It was quantitative restrictions. It was quantitative reductions. Inflation was on the roof, and we had new sheriffs, and they were brave. I mean, Volcker, really? You're talking about a guy, and he raised rates to bring on a recession, to bring down inflation. That was feasible because it was 50 years ago, and the cycle was changing. Okay. So what I want to say is, what happened next? All of that worked. And inflation came off the ceiling and now it's on the floor. It took 50 years, but we made that. The hero's journey is complete. And the capitalists, the people who own the businesses, like from, let's call it 1981, each year incrementally, they got to kind of take more of the spoils. And today, 50 years later, hand on heart, they're getting too much. So let's call them the creditors. And just like the unions in the 1970s who had imposed an economic rent on us, we now find it's not the unions, but it's these rich folk who've built these barriers and they're keeping us down in serfdom. And so that cycle is changing. Having Trump as president is that's I don't want to say that he's the new Reagan, but he is he is iconic in terms of a new cycle, okay? The British rejection of the European Union is Trump. That's Trumpism. That is iconic that the cycle is changing. And here we are. We've had this catastrophe, this pandemic, and it's revealing that the state is getting bigger, bolder, and it's becoming more of a risk taker, and it's beginning to reemerge into our lives. Now everyone is dependent on the state. The cycle is changing, and you better make sure that your portfolio is in sync with this new cycle. This is a cycle where the challenge, if you're a risk taker and you're wealthy, your number one challenge. I was talking to someone recently who is a confidant of the legendary David Tepper, the incredible money manager, and like no one swung from the, you know, no one swung for risk more than David, a legend, a calculated risk taker. And David's saying today, there's a time to take risk, but don't you forget, there's a time to preserve your capital. Right. That's kind of where we are with this cycle.
Going back to the 1970s, one thing that's really hard for me to figure out, because I've tried to figure out, well, why did we have inflation there? It's you just hear the oil shock and a lot of these things that kind of people just throw out. And you ask yourself, is that really what happened? And one thing that confuses me is I look at almost every single country around the world, and they almost all had inflation. I mean, you look at Saudi Arabia, you look at Japan, you look at all these other countries, and it looked like it was a global phenomenon. So I have a hard time connecting all the dots in my mind as to what actually caused this thing, because so many of the reasons we attribute to this inflation in the 1970s was kind of U.S. specific, is that it just had this, because the U.S. was kind of the main economy, it just had this kind of trickle through effect with every other economy in the world, or what would you put the cause of the 1970s inflation, the global inflation that we experienced?
Well, George, I've got your back. I got the answers.
I've got the questions. Give me the answers.
You got the questions. I got the answers. Now, can I deliver the answer in a succinct manner? Okay, let's try.
Remember, I got some great editors, Hugh. We can just edit it all together, and we'll make us both look like a genius.
Well, let me see if I can do the genius thing on my own. So banks. The answer is commercial private banks. Okay. And it's also the answer as to why, despite all of this kind of helicopter money from the Federal Reserve, despite the Federal Reserve's balance sheet today being like 3x the U.S. economy, being $50 trillion, despite that, we have no inflation today, but we had inflation in the 1970s. So let's begin by talking about the banks.
Okay.
And I told you about these kind of cycles of 40 or 50 years, which are the majority of a kind of human life on this year planet. The banks had gone bust in 1930, 1931, 1932. And one of the lessons was that the banks had become too aggressive. They were taking too much risk. And in doing so, they had endangered the US society and they had brought on the depression. And so the legislative challenge was to de-risk the banks, okay? And, you know, it's easy. You legislate for it. And so for the next 40 years, from 1930 to 1970, you had incredibly tough regulation, which made it hard for banks to expand risk-taking on their book. Okay. Mm-hmm. And as you know, like we didn't, one of the most obvious examples was that a savings bank was not allowed to make, like, wasn't allowed to do investment banking. So you had this, can't happen, you know, that's called an investment bank, you're a savings bank, demarcation. And the second thing was, we were like, we've got to make sure that the people who work for banks are like just boring people who take a salary, you don't get a share of profits, you don't like, you're not on a, no one's on a percentage of the upside, you're working for a utility. And so by the 1960s, US banks were just a really great savings product. You got like a 6% yield, and you just collect, it was a bond, you know, like for your, talking about those pension funds and the need to get a 7% real return. What happened? And if you go back, I know you were talking to the legend, Jimmy Rogers. Jimmy maintains that his first trade with George was in recognizing that something profound was afoot with banks, that banks, like, you, first of all, universities were beginning to run these MBA programs, and banks were starting to send their talent pool to these courses, and the kids were coming back and they're like, I kind of get it. I understand finance. I want to be
the late
60s? Late 60s, yeah. Okay. Late 60s, okay. Early 70s. Yeah. George, the financial backers to George Soros, George began his hedge fund in 1969, and the people who gave him the seed capital were the people who gave me my seed capital, so I kind of know the stories quite well.
Oh, wow, very.
And so, and George, it all coincides with this cycle thing. But anyway, Jimmy began to recognize that the banks and the chief executive, the guys who were beginning to do the presentation to investors, were like nothing we'd seen in 40 years. They were starting to talk our language, the language of taking a bit of risk, making a bit of money, but they were priced as utilities. And so one of the first big equity Soros trades was coming in and just buying these US banks that had this, who were radicalizing their leadership, okay? So I'm saying to you, we had banks that wanted to take risk, okay?
Right.
Secondly, you mentioned Saudi Arabia. So we had, of course, the oil price went shooting higher, okay? The cartel of OPEC. Once, when you repriced oil from like you know, like from bucks, like from 40 cents in the dollar to 12 bucks or whatever the move was in 1973, 74. Yeah. Billions of dollars flooded in to Saudi Arabia. You know, its current account surplus was enormous. Okay.
Right,
and
right.
So it's like Japan in the 1980s, they've got to do something. So what do they do? They buy treasury bonds, of course. But then financial revolution from these NBA guys at the banks, they create the euro dollar market. So the Saudis and these other oil producing nations, they start putting their oil cash into the euro dollar market, which is financing US banks. So suddenly you've got the coincidence of ambition, like people who want to take risk leading the large US banks, and you've got the funding, which is to say you had an explosion in bank lending.
Right.
When you have bank lending, M2, the broadest money supply definition series we have today, it takes off. When M2 starts trending, prices and inflation go higher.
And velocity. So how did velocity play into it back then, Hugh?
So you got velocity. Velocity is nothing more than a culture and a willingness to take risk by the private sector, banking sector. Velocity.
So it's a psychological phenomenon.
Well, it's a psychological phenomenon to accept more risk, okay? Accepting more risk is to make another loan, to make another loan, to make a bigger loan, to make another. And like loans beget loans beget loans beget loans. And suddenly that's your helicopter money. That's the money that ends up in your pocket. And you think, gee, I had a good week. Honey, I think we should go to St. Bart's. I think we should blow the budget. Let's spend money, you know. I'm fed up with this wine. Let's have some champagne. I'm fed up with this car. Like, let's just buy a limousine. You know,
yeah,
let's move to, you know, whatever, Beverly Hills. All funded by banks. Now, since 2008, again, lessons have not been learned. So after the housing debacle, the house price decline nationwide across America, which they told us could never happen, but it happened. Policymakers said, gee, these banks, they're like enemy number one. They facilitated this. They put us in danger. We got to de-risk these guys. And so we started, and we did this across the world. The thing that I dislike intensely is the Basel Agreement number 3 to regulate the global banking sector.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like the Bible says, you have been a sinner. You must repent, you know.
Right.
And they are trying to in Europe, they have, in Europe and in Japan, they have succeeded in changing their banking sectors into utilities that don't want to take risk. And so if we look at, let's choose the country of France, because I live back and forward in French territories and I know the data. French bank loans have been growing at 2% per annum for the last 6, 7, 8 years, right? You ain't going to generate economic prosperity. You ain't going to get people into good jobs. The people who are in jobs are not going to be able to get higher salaries and better jobs. You're in penury. Again, I call it serfdom. You're stuck and life's gray. It's like black and white television, okay? And that's an ideology. And that's why you can print trillions of dollars if you're the Federal Reserve. But unless you ignite and you change your ideology such that you're willing to accept a risk-taking and a vibrant U.S. banking sector, you're never going to get liftoff. So that's how that's why we had inflation in the 1970s, and that's why we've not had it for the last 10 years.
I just want to clarify for everyone watching, part of what Hugh's talking about is the fact that the commercial banking system creates the majority of the money supply in the real economy. And in order for us to see great price inflation with the CPI or in the goods and services in the real economy, and not just financial assets, there has to be a mechanism for transferring bank reserves, which the Fed can print 50 trillion, 100 trillion, whatever. And it just stays under their mattress, so to speak. It's just in the bank reserves. It's in the banking system, in the financial system. But the commercial banks have to take action, and then, of course, consumers have to take action by there being demand for loans. So there's a psychological component there. I think it also goes back to and I'd love your take on this. Correct me if I'm wrong. I think you've read Werner's book. You're saying that with your in your interview with Raul. And so I think Warner's take on it, which I find fascinating, is that there were different rounds of quantitative easing back in 2008, or different methods. There was the Japanese method that they did back in the early 90s, which Warner didn't like at all. There was the Bank of England's approach. Then there was the Fed approach. And I think what happened with the BOJ is that they didn't clean up the balance sheets of the banks. And because they didn't clean up the balance sheets of the banks, they weren't able to lend. And it really stifled the lending that you're talking about. So I guess I don't want to go off on a tangent, but my main question is, to get this velocity in the real economy moving forward, how big of a factor is the consumer balance sheet to that? Because if they're completely levered up, they can't take on any more debt, even if they wanted to. And incomes are, if they're not rising fast enough to service the debt, how does that play into the equation?
Okay, so I believe it's called Say's Law. Say's was a French economist, France again, I'm on a French thing. Say's Law says that supply creates its own demand. It comes from, I want to say, the 18th century.
Right.
The best example of that is the Italian economy. Just, they have so much government. They've always had lots of government debt. And you always sit there going, you know, I think today government debt is, I want to say, 130% of GDP. It's a big number for an economy. I mean, this is not Japan. Japan is bigger, but Japan is, you know, it's more economically professional. It's more productive.
And they can print their own money. Italy can't.
And they can print. And that's a very, very true thing. But, and so you sit there thinking, they're never, who's going to buy this stuff? Someone buys it. Supply creates its demand. So my point is, I wouldn't worry about, I think it's always wise to worry about everything. But in terms of being the catalyst, I don't think the consumer balance sheet is the number one target or issue here. Again, it is, Richard Werner's book, The Princes of the Yen, again, basically, I've been quoting it. He was saying, like, this. He was the originator of this term, quantitative easing.
Yeah, I know.
And he maintains that these are all programs of ideology, and that if you want to create if you want today to have, so you know, the critique of the last 5 or so years is that inflation is below the target of all global central banks. It's too low, and you know, if you speak to Raul today at Real Vision, he's terrified that we're going to see outright deflation. That's like everything he sees is going to take us there. And Richard's point, which I keep just stealing, is like, I can create inflation for you tomorrow. No problem. Tell me what rate you want. It's easy. I would go back to the system they had as we saw Volcker emerge at the Federal Reserve, and I would unwind all of that great work, and I would introduce this thing called window guidance. And I'd say, okay, we have, choose a number. Let's say we've got 5,000 banks, commercial banks in the US. You know, you're bank number one, you're bank number two. I'm a bureaucrat. Okay. Here's your allocation. You know, I'm the government, and I dictate to you that over the next year, I want you to expand your loan book by 10%. Now, if we have this conversation 1 year's time and I discover that you couldn't find enough people who were credit worthy, and therefore you tell me, hey, look, gee, I really tried, but you know, we could only expand our loan book by 2%. Okay, you're fired. You've lost your bank license. Okay, bank number two. Okay, I hope you're hearing that conversation, because here's your credit allocation. I want you to expand loans to the great US consumer by 10% per annum. If you fail to achieve that, you, like this bozo next to me, you're going to lose your bank license. Okay,
yeah,
I tell you, in 2 years' time, you'll have whatever inflation rate you want. Those banks, like in Japan, we all thought that, again, we all have these cultural stereotypes. We thought the Japanese were great savers and very prudent. The banks had to expand their balance sheet between 1986 and 1989, when the Nikkei flared to 40,000.
Yeah.
The Bank of Japan was saying to these banks, you have to expand loans every year by 15%. And they were like, but that's impossible. You know, we can't find anyone. The bank is, I'm not listening. You have to.
Why did they want to do that back then, Hugh?
They wanted to do that very simply. They wanted to do that because they were coming under huge political duress from the U.S. government because the U.S. economy was strong, and Japan, like China, Japan was the original, if you will, China.
Right.
Imports from Japan were wiping out. This was when we saw, we'd seen the closure across the Midwest of all these steel plants and manufacturing. They were all going to Asia and they were all going to Japan. And then when the U.S. picked up, suddenly Japan was just getting richer and richer and richer. And when you try to export great American products to Japan, there was like regulation after regulation after regulation. And so the U.S. in the mid-1980s went, hold on, wait a minute. This has got to stop, okay? And if you don't make it stop, we're going to put quotas. So what the Japanese decided, they said, we've got to create a boom, a domestic boom, where our economy grows like rapidly, because the consequences of that are our consumers are going to buy American products, and therefore we'll get balance, if you will, in the current account and the trades. The trade surplus will become less, and we will become less contentious to our American consumers and paymasters. And so they stoked a great, great boom. And it's very easy. You just instruct the banking sector to do what you tell them to.
Yeah, but then you got some serious unintended consequences of that one.
So the stock market peaks at 40,000, and yeah, it spends the next 30 years in a bear market. Yeah, that's the consequence, yeah. But is that the consequence? I would say to you, that happened. So this is a kind of, I don't really have the null hypothesis. We can't go back and demonstrate parallel universes. But the stock market peaked kind of almost on the 31st of December, 1989.
Yeah.
And it peaked because the ideology, that word again, ideology changed. And the Bank of Japan then became concerned at just how the nouveau riche and how the basic cultural foundations of Japan looked as if they were being challenged by this easy money. And so they began to raise rates. And of course, a system, they'd spent 10 years building a system based on more and more credit. Yeah. And then they started taking credit out and went bang. And ideology by Japanese policymakers for 30 years has kept the Japanese down, ideology.
And if when you talk about ideology, you're saying it kept keeping it down. You're saying if they would have taken Warner's approach and cleaned up the balance sheets of the banks, then they would have been off to the races again. Do you agree with them there, or do you have a different approach?
No, I think you're misunderstanding Richard a little bit. I know he watches these things, and I'm sure he will see it somehow.
And Richard, if you're watching, you know you've got an open invitation to for an interview. I've asked him several times because I love his stuff. He's great.
Because I'm the poor man's Richard, but hey, I am the brand ambassador of Richard. So Richard's point is they cleaned up the banks. They cleaned up the banks.
Oh, they did.
The government took on all their bad debts, but in doing so, the government took the credit risk, but then it issued bonds to the Japanese nation. So they were taking money out of the system. And so, like, on the one hand, they were giving, on the other hand, they were taking away. And so kind of nothing, you had inertia. The Japanese economy has, but let's call it 20 years, has been trapped by inertia. And Richard's point is, hey, the economy, the debt now is like, I want to say government debt is like 2.6 times GDP. It's a high number, but hey, they can print. Okay. But if you want that to come down, the denominator has to start growing faster than the numerator. Yeah. So the economy, if we could, like, this is what happened after the Second World War. The denominator, the GDP, it grew very fast in America and globally because banks were lending money. Okay. So if Richard were talking to you, Richard would say, we could generate 5%. What does China grow at? China grows at 7% per annum. These guys have been playing this textbook for 25, 30 years. Like, Japan could have that Chinese growth rate. Anyone could be Chinese in terms of their GDP growth rate if you command and direct your commercial banking sector to expand their loan book, and let's call it, you know, 2x GDP or 3x GDP, you're going to get, GDP is going to pick up. It's going to pick up. So we can do it, but it depends where you are with ideology, and it's typically it's ideology and the fear of what happens if I do that, that stops people from doing that.
Don't you have a misallocation of resources? That's where your moral hazard, a misallocation of resources. I mean, if you got the hurdle rate down at nothing and you're throwing money at people, it just seems scarce resources with alternative uses. I don't know.
Sure. We're at a point where there's no
good answers.
There's no good option, right? Every option comes with like bad consequences. Okay.
Yeah.
So you have very, you know, eloquently come out with the bad consequences of what I'm recommending. Okay. But let me throw it back to you. Another bad consequence is Trump's entertaining, whatever, but he's kind of a scary guy. But you get Trump too. Like, you get him for a second. Governments get controlled by people who want to control your life. We move from democracies to something really, really horrible. Like, whenever ideology has been worried about those unintended consequences of malinvestment, of a weak dollar, things like that, you end up getting wars. Like, you get people fighting each other. And what I'd say to you is, I would always choose malinvestment over war. Like I say, be a lover, don't be a hater.
Well, that's the ultimate malinvestment, is war.
Sure.
All right, Hugh, you've been really gracious with your time, man. I could go on and on and on about this stuff. This has just been one of the best interviews I've ever had. But I know that the viewers are going to be so angry with me if we don't get back to the one question. How you talked about your portfolio for the average Joe or Jane being in sync with current economic times. What did you mean by that? And what type of advice would you give to the average person watching this interview?
I don't know about this term average. I don't like this term average, but like I like to quote David Tepper again, there's a time to speculate and there's a time not to speculate. This is not the time to speculate. This game has changed. Like, so it used to be the winning strategy, the thing that beat every expert like me, every pro, looks like a dumbass. When you consider the investment strategy of the permanent portfolio, I'm sure at some point it's going to be on your whiteboard. You're going to explain the concept of the permanent portfolio, risk parity. The biggest hedge fund in the world, Ray Dalio, kind of plays this theme. He does it like with adjusting for risk, but you sit there with 25% of your portfolio in precious metals, gold, and maybe a bit of silver. You sit there with 25% in the S&P, or maybe have a bit of NASDAQ or whatever. You know, you sit there with 25% in government bonds. You might have a little bit at the short end. You might have a little bit at the long end. You might even have a bit of commercial. And then you sit there with kind of cash and looking for opportunities. You sit there. That strategy for the last 40 years has just wiped everyone. It's the leader. It's the Olympic. It's the Usain Bolt or whatever. I don't know the American sporting analogies to make, but it has hit the ball out of the park time after time after time.
Yeah.
It's finished. This is a time to preserve capital. Mm-hmm. It's a time to preserve capital. But lastly, if you got to have something, I'd say don't have too much because it's going to test you. But this is a time which probably favors holding some gold. You can buy it via an ETF or you can have the physical thing. And gold is, I like to call it, as it's hideously kinky. I just like saying that it's hideously kinky. And what I mean by that is, it has this split personality. It's like your best friend and you're like, ah, God, I really love George. And then you're like, no, I hate you. You're such a jerk. I'm like, what happened to George? He was like such a great guy yesterday. Gold is a bit like
that. Like being married. Sounds like having a wife, right?
Yeah. I didn't say that. You said that. As you know, my wife burnt all. She didn't burn my book. She threw them all out. But anyway, look on my Instagram page for that story. What I was trying to say is that there are times when gold feels, it performs like a zero coupon treasury.
Yeah.
Which is to say, if Raul is correct, and ideology is still strong and we have deflation, like gold is just incredible. But before we get there, sometimes gold can flip. So in October 2008, when we had a deflationary event, when risk assets were falling, gold became, what would you call it? It became like a TIPS, like an index-linked treasury coupon, which is to say it kind of performed like a FANG, like a very highly rated equity, which is to say it falls. So you got to be careful. And like I say, you probably should have a gold allocation, but you should be able, like gold today, what price is gold today? Gold is, I should know this answer. Let's call it $2,000. That may be a wish, but gold could easily be $1,500, $1,400 before it then goes higher again.
Yeah.
And you got to promise me, if you're going to have gold, you got to be able to wear like a 20, at least a 20, 25% haircut on the thing before it then takes off. So be careful.
All right, Hugh, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it. For any of my viewers who want to find out more about your thoughts or your incredible experience or what you're doing right now, which we didn't even get the time to talk about, I'll have to have you back on very, very soon to discuss all the neat things you're doing in the present. But where can they go to find out more about you?
Oh, so I have started dropping Twitter bombs, tweet bombs or whatever, under Hendry_Hugh or at Hendry_Hugh. But my passion is I'm trying to build an Instagram. I do things the wrong way around. I kind of like fighting. I don't know why I make it hard for myself, because I know that finance folk, they don't feel comfortable in Instagram, but it's fun, right? And let's make life fun. So I'm Hugh Hendry Official, and join me on Hugh Hendry Official. I've got 2,500 followers, and I promise you it's going to be entertaining, and maybe, just maybe, you might learn something.
Okay, fantastic, Hugh. I can't wait to do it again, buddy.
Thank you. Thank you, George.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.